Recording. Okay. Okay, so for those who are slightly late, then I've actually photocopied the chapter out of Bowie's book on filters. We're going to look at some filters today. All right. This is, I'm going to revise a lot of what I did in the last lecture, except I won't go back and do mixes. There's plenty of information on the web about them. And the upshot of mixes in this project is that they only come into a paper design because every mixer you use is integrated. Oh, not in the case of the 1496, but the 1496 is easy to design with anyway, okay? You program its transfer function, it's game. So mixes are pretty easy. In this lecture I'm going to describe frequency synthesizers, and once we do that we'll have enough in order to be able to understand the chips that you'll be using in the project, apart from the 1496, which you should theoretically already understand. And then at the end of the this lecture, I'm going to discuss filters. Now, you'll notice that that original program that I wrote up for you in the first lecture has kind of gone by the wayside now. As I've written the lectures and I've seen how things have evolved, like you see now, we're turning into the point where you can start to do real calculations. And we'll start. Well, mixers wasn't a real chapter on that. The first one was matching networks. That was the first example of real calculations that you can do. Today we do our second one, which is filters, and then next week I'll look at transistor amplifiers and oscillators. So we're going to learn all about small signal transistors next week, and then very soon power amplifiers as well. And the web notes are now up to date as of at least transmission lines, which is where you are approximately heading toward, I think, because exercises 10 to 16 are already in transmission lines, and so that's most of the rest you have to do that I've set up on the web so far. Okay, won't be very many more. When we get to antennas, I have to put one or two in there, and so on. All right, so that's the agenda for today. And I'm going to go back to this project description again. Just to remind you, there are two projects. There's a third project for those doing the master's course, which is a 900 megahertz device. These two projects are low frequency devices. The first one is based on the 1496 balanced modulator demodulator, which I explained to you in detail yesterday. Did everyone understand that description, first of all, of the 1496? Remember, it was, I'm sure I have the circuit diagram of it here, that funny stack transistor thing. Oh. I don't have it in this lecture. Oh, there's all my view graphs for this lecture. Don't have it. You know what I mean, do you, or not? The 1496. Who understood that discussion I put up on the board yesterday showing you how it multiplies? Yeah, you understood it? One person? Don't be afraid to say yes if you do. But if you don't, you can't remember it. Right, well, the circuit looked like this. I mean, you couldn't miss this circuit. I bet it's the most complicated transistor circuit you've seen unless you've looked at an op-amp in a data sheet and they actually showed you the circuit, which they often do. This one's probably the most complicated transistor circuit you've ever understood. Maybe for the ridiculous cross... Now it's starting to ring a bell, Nick?
Yeah, it rings a bell around
it. You still don't understand it. Right, we'll discuss it in the lab this afternoon again for those who don't understand it, okay? One project's built on that. It's an easy device to use, the 1496. I even have some sample circuits which already work with it in it, so you can have a look at what you have to do in order to make... it's not exactly what you have to build, but it shows you all the biasing. You can turn the thing on, you can measure the voltages, you can check it against your own circuit, you can design your own circuit around it. I'll show you that in the lab this afternoon, if somebody reminds me. So who's coming to lab this afternoon? Should be all of you guys, just about. Yeah, somebody remind me and I'll show you. Right, and then there's a second one which is built on just two devices, apart from the pin diodes and the preselector, which is the digital project. All right? Righto. Now, what I like about transceiver one is everything's based around this 1496, which is easy. I reckon that the TR switch, if you read that student's, if you go to where I say project files on the web and download pin diodes, that student describes all about how you do that circuit, including the layout for it. And that is relevant for 900 megs, and therefore, ergo, it's relevant for 50 megs, right? You can do something tough, you can do something easy. The LNA, It's a chip. Okay, so there shouldn't be any design there much. The PA, the amplifier, and the local oscillator NC145170. That's the frequency synthesizer. Local oscillator is actually a discrete transistor circuit you're building. Those are the main challenges in this project. Okay. And apart from the LNA, you can build all of that on a circuit board before having a circuit board made up. Right, so transistor one is discrete. It's easy to understand. It's flexible, of course. It's it's going to be easier to do this project in a one-off, okay? Easiest for those who understand the theoretical aspects of the course, because it uses almost everything you learn in this course.
What's one-off?
Means you just do... that's bad English. That should be a one-off, shouldn't it? Well, it's good Australian English, it should be a one-off, shouldn't it?
Is that what you say when you order things that...
That'd be 20 off.
What?
Was it 20 off? I've been doing it for 40 years, but I still don't know what it is. It just means if you build one, one only. You want to buy some paper in a newsagent and say one off, and you probably mean a batch of it, but not 10. It's 10 off.
It's very English. I should have stopped. Shouldn't have done it.
Cheaper and faster to do one of them. Easiest for those who understand the theoretical aspects of the course. So if you're good at RF design and you think you understood what I've said, then this thing won't hold any challenges for you. Can do a breadboard debug prototype, which is even better. You can experiment with what you think you know and check it all out before you commit to a circuit design. Righto, then this next device is totally digital. Remember this one here, it's digital inputs from the baseband processor. The bytes come in here and come out here without any need for an ADC or a DAC. So that's cute. One problem is that you'll need a computer to know even what its signals are looking like, which is cute. I think the way we'll do that is we'll acquire the digital signals on a logic state analyzer, then you can analyze them in MATLAB by turning the bits back into analog signals by multiplying by 2 to the power of k and adding them up. How about that? So if you do this project, that's the only way we'll be able to check whether this is working. The AD9854 is the frequency up converter. It is the frequency source. It's the transmitter. It's also the modulatable transmitter. It's what they call a data converter. A data converter is a device where you put bits in one end and you get an analog modulated RF signal at the other end. You just tell it what you want. And we'll have a look at its architecture in this lecture. The down converter is a similar reverse magical device, and it has 90 dB of gain, which is a lot, so it doesn't need an LNA. So you've got the power amplifier project, no local oscillator or phase lock loop to learn about. The preselector is the filter, which we learn how to build in this lecture. The TR switch, as I've explained, and the power amplifier and so on, you have in common with the other project, except that this will probably put out less signal. In fact, it will put out less signal than the VCO, so you have to have a bit more amplification there. All right, so I've pretty much said all that. The main difference here with this one is this is for people who want to say, well, I've got the data sheet, I know the pinouts, I've got a design circuit, I think I've got a good layout, I'll just bang it out in Eagle, here you are, make it for me. And then 2 weeks later, and it'll take 2 weeks, right, the circuit boards will come back, unless Luke can help us out, the circuit boards will come back in 2 weeks, and you can solder it up, and then get it to work. And it's a pretty tough surface mount soldering job. So for those who do that project, there's a bit of reading to make sure you understand it, and then you make the circuit out. And there'll be test circuits that you can copy for that. And these are expensive devices, but if you buy them in bulk, then you save on all those extra components and it soon becomes a cheaper device to build. Right, okay. Now back to the meat. Frequency synthesizers. Frequency synthesizers provide the source of radio frequency carrier signals. If you work at the ACMA, then these are the cause of your problems. Without these, you wouldn't have a job. But then we wouldn't have wireless communications or anything at radio anyway, and Marconi would have been wasting his time. These are the things that produce the signals. Two types of circuit used, basically. When you look at circuits that produce analog RF signals, there are just two of them, really. One of them is a phase lock loop with a voltage-controlled oscillator. There's a bit of an assumption in that. I think somewhere I've written that I might even have a photograph on it, but if you get up above 10 gigahertz, or you want to go up above 10 watts, then the way you produce RF does change. You may know, for example, that if you want to produce 10 megawatts of RF power with one single device at 30 megahertz, or a half to probably 500 megahertz, actually. What would you do, Luke? If you want 10 megawatts at 500 megahertz, what would you do?
10 megahertz is 400 watts.
Yeah, one device, it'll cost you $200,000, and it's about this big. What is it? What do you call it? Triad. You've heard of triads, haven't you? Who hasn't heard of triads? You haven't heard of triads? Yeah, triads. If you go to any audio hi-fi system from built in the 1950s or earlier, it'll have triads and pentodes in it, guaranteed, before the age of transistors. Right? They've completely been supplanted. You should go and read silicon. Yeah, what you need to do is read, silicon. There's a magazine, silicon. Silicon chip. Silicon chip? Yeah, I think so. Or one of those. It has a section called Vintage Radio, and on the front it has a picture of an old valve radio. No, silicon chip is nowadays. But it has these really interesting articles on Vintage Radio. So that's always written by an amateur radio enthusiast, right? I did so. Yeah, anyway, triads. That's what they'd have to use, because that's the only thing the triads can do now. Although there are some guitar amplifier freaks who think that you should still make guitar amplifiers with triads and not use transistors. Okay, I don't know if you knew that. Some people would definitely know that, I'm sure. That's why I'm surprised nobody's heard of triads and pentodes.
They tend to call them tubes in guitar amps, though.
Yeah, the tubes. That's what they are. They're triads, usually pentodes, though. They're a bit better than triads. Triad was the first one. Very simple devices, okay. But the advantage is they're all made of metal and glass, tungsten and vacuum. And so they do one thing that transistors can't do. They can suck up 10 megawatts from a DC, big DC power supply and turn it into RF, and then use that to blast out the side of a mountain or whatever. Okay, so that's how you do that. And now if you go to higher frequencies, things get tough too. If you want a little bit of power, above 10 gigahertz, you would have an impact oscillator or a gun oscillator, gun diodes. They're semiconductor devices. But just like with triads, there are all these devices like gyrotrons, klystrons, magnetrons that have survived the semiconductor era of high power and high frequency. Who's never heard of travelling wave tubes? They sit them in satellites. You've heard of travelling wave tubes? No, never heard of them. Okay. What about magnetrons? You must have heard of that magnetron. Who can you've heard of them? Yeah. Who hasn't heard of magnetrons? Oh! Who hasn't cooked their food in a microwave oven? Everybody has cooked their food. Microwave ovens use magnetrons to get their power. You can't do it with a transistor. 300 watts, 2.5 gigahertz, the cheapest way is a magnetron. Okay. Gyrotrons are magnetrons that have gone crazy. They're bigger, they're relativistic, they send electrons up near the speed of light, and they can work up to 200 gigahertz, 1 megawatt. Okay? And gyrotrons are what they actually use to blast the side out of a mountain. Just aim them at a quarry. It's the way they do it in Russia, right? Then they probably don't care what's on the other side of the mountain. All right, two types of circuit, phase lock loop and voltage controlled oscillator. This is the real realm now. If you go back and look at how wireless LANs work, this is how they do it. And there are direct digital devices as well.
Spark gap
is not an RF source. And a spark gap is just a high voltage pin very near the opposite polarity electrode that goes bang, and they're used as triggers. So what it's a kind of switch. So you have a circuit, right, that you're going to blast or apply high voltage to. You raise the potential and the spark gap breaks down and connects the circuit to the high voltage supply.
Isn't that got like a step function and
yep.
Mm,
yeah, and spark gaps rarely produce RF, but they're not a wave.
Isn't that how they did it initially? Like
yep.
Very first
Yes, I've even done that as a PhD student. When I wanted to launch a lot of power into a plasma, at 500 kilohertz, I did an LC circuit on one side of the spark, you charge it up and the thing goes bang, and it lasts for about 10 milliseconds. Oh, not even that. It was at 500 kilohertz. It must have been 10 to 100 microseconds anyway. So it's a very short RF pulse, and then it dies out. Because there's no power supply. As soon as the spark gap discharges the capacitor it's feeding, it's all over. And it can't keep doing it forever, or you burn the gap. Okay, anyway, that's another high power, very, very low frequency situation. All right. Here's a phase lock loop. Who's seen a phase lock loop before? You've all at least heard of it. Who hasn't heard of a phase lock loop? Because if you haven't, Brick 4 from my other course is on the web and explains in the depth. If you think you haven't had enough information in the past about phase lock loops, there's a lot there. You haven't heard of phase lock loops? Phase lock loop, yes. They've been around for a long time. They're analog servo circuits. At radio frequency, a chip that professes to be a phase lock loop rarely comes with a VCO. In other words, a voltage control oscillator. You have to build it yourself or supply it from somewhere else. But this is a typical circuit. Now, when you learnt about phase lock loops in the past, I'm sure that the most important thing about them, the divide by N counters, weren't mentioned, and they're absolutely crucial. So this is what a phase lock loop is. There's a lot of mathematical symbols on that. I'm not going to go into the mathematics, so ignore them. Just read the English. There's a clock reference that comes in here. This is a stable clock. Remember, the name of the game here is to produce a tunable, accurate radio frequency signal where you can say this is its frequency accurately. Okay, that's what you want to do. A phase lock loop is a feedback loop with an oscillator whose frequency is controlled by a DC voltage that is pushed to the right frequency. And this servo loop does the pushing. This is how you do it. All right. R is a big integer. We're going to see. The device we're describing now is the MC145170 chip. This circle with a squiggle on it is your voltage-controlled oscillator that you have to build out of a discrete transistor. So there are those two things. R is a counter which divides the frequency of the clock reference down. It's usually a big number, and you'll see why it has to be in a minute. N is another counter with a different value to R. These are both integers, of course. It's just one of those shift register counters in all cases, right? And it divides down the VCO frequency. This yellow thing is not very well labelled, but it's a phase detector, and it measures the phase difference between these two signals. This is a low-pass filter, and the output of this low-pass filter is used to drive the VCO. So you can see it's a feedback loop. In fact, it's absolutely no different to a squirrel cage motor in its mathematics. Okay, what it does is that, first of all, these things, there's a bit of magic that occurs, and that magic is, how does this darn thing get locked in the first place? You set the N and the R values to fixed values, right? After you set them, you don't change them. And so what's happening here is you hope like crazy that the frequency of the VCO is such that the FVCO divided by N is equal to the frequency of the clock reference divided by R at some time. When that happens, the phase detector then will detect some output because it's going to a low-pass filter there, and a voltage will be developed on that filter. As soon as a voltage is developed at the filter, which is here, then it pushes the VCO so that the frequencies correspond to each other, and this guy is stuck at that ratio. Right, let's ask a question. Is there an input? Sorry? The clock reference? It's a low frequency clock signal, usually, 10 megahertz. You can buy them off the shelf from Farnell for about $10, I suppose. You can buy a 16 megahertz clock. You apply 5 volts to it, and it produces a 16 megahertz clock with an accuracy of 100 parts per minute. The voltage-controlled oscillator just sees a DC voltage. All right, this is a phase detector. There are all sorts of phase detectors.
So let's look at just one example. How about the phase detector we learned about yesterday?
The 1496 behaving as a phase detector, or it's got to be a phase detector.
Now that means that if the clock signal is sine omega 1t, and at some particular time, and when I say the clock, I really mean here, after, but sorry, I may as well put it in. It's going to be the clock frequency divided by R, and the VCO frequency divided by NT, and there's some phase shift. You put those into a phase detector, then the output of the phase detector is proportional to omega V over N minus omega C over R by T plus phi. Okay? That's what the phase detector does. And we saw a phase detector yesterday, namely a balanced mixer, which gives you that with a cosine out the front.
And they use those phase detectors too in phase lock loops.
Righto. So there's the answer to your question. The output here, before going into the filter, is this thing, not the clock signal. This is the signal after the clock has been divided by R. So the clock signal, the original clock signal, is sine omega CT, and the original VCO signal is sine omega V. Well, if I say it's sine omega VT plus phi, then I've really got to divide that phase by N as well. Okay.
Everyone clear on that mathematics? Be very careful. A squirrel cage motor is easy to understand because you can see it working, right? The magnetic field in the stator rotates, and the rotor starts to rotate with it. It gets pulled. It's exactly what's happening here mathematically. The trouble is that the feedback is in the phase domain. In other words, this phase gets converted to a voltage which drives this, and the voltage gets converted to a frequency. So this loop has some derivatives where frequency is the derivative, time derivative of phase, and so on. It is not important in this course for you to understand how a phase lock loop works. That was the job of another course. And if you really feel the need to understand the gory details, then read Brick 4 from the 3214 course, which I might give it a different name and stick it right up on the ARIC website for those who are interested. However, so what's happening here is that this VCO is being forced, the aim of the phase lock loop is to force this equality. In other words, omega over V is omega C over R, okay?
That's what it's forcing. All right, just a bit of background again. I've just explained it has a phase detector. It has prescalers to allow frequency tuning because the frequency at the output of the VCO is given by N over R times the clock frequency. So F clock divided by R controls the frequency resolution of this device by changing. If R is 10,000 and you change it by 1, then your minimum frequency step in the phase lock loop is going to be the clock frequency divided by 10,000, the integer multiples of that. So if that clock frequency is a megahertz, then you're dividing by 10,000. So you can tune your RF frequency in 100 hertz steps. That's the way. Now, if you think that's great, you should see what a DDS can do. I'll explain that in a minute. It also has a loop filter. There's always a filter in a servo loop, so the thing doesn't go jittery and crazy. Voltage-controlled oscillator, which you build, is quite a separate component. Sometimes, at low frequency, you can get phase lock loops which have all you need, including the VCO. In fact, we did a project with one last year, but that's not the case for the MC145-170, and here it is. It operates up to 185 megahertz, right? What that means is, it doesn't have a VCO, what that means is that its prescalers work at that frequency. That's all that ever has to happen. Providing you can count the cycles of the RF, then that phase lock loop qualifies to be called a phase lock loop that operates at that frequency, okay? 185 megahertz. Look at the division range. The counter goes down to 32,000 and the end counter, 40, integer 40, up to 65,535. Right. So you now see the clock in actual fact is going to be a radio frequency clock, probably
one half or one quarter of your wanted RF frequency. The difference with the clock is, of course, it can't tune it. It just sits there at that frequency. If you want to have a frequency in the ISM band or in your amateur radio band or wherever, then the VCO gets pushed there by the phase lock loop using the clock as its reference. And the other thing I've been experimenting with, and I've got a working version of this FC145170 with a local oscillator. It works quite well. It has low phase noise, which I was chuffed about. But it has this fancy bit grabbing device which simplifies digital communications. It's a special Motorola patented communication system. So it's not SPI, which serial peripheral interface, which some of you will be having to deal with.
And it makes life easier, and I've got a program that does that already for the computer parallel port.
Can I just ask a question about that cosine thing there? That's what comes out of the phase lock loop. Mm. The phase detector.
Mm.
And that goes to the low pass filter.
Yes.
Sorry, that's an
alternating
voltage.
It's an oscillating voltage, yeah. Oh, so if these are not equal, then this is a sine wave or cos wave, yeah.
You said the VCO is driven by where's
that in the diagram?
Yeah.
So
where was that
in the diagram? Oh, the VCO was kind of. Yeah, that's it there. That's that oscillating cosine after being filtered. And then the out there, I don't show it here, this is in the way, but this is sent to the VCO from there. Is that your question?
VCO is controlled by DC voltage.
It is. Well, it is controlled by, that is the DC voltage.
You said it's oscillating.
Yeah, oh, it's only oscillating while these differ. When they don't differ, it's a DC voltage. And that's the whole point of the phase lock loop. That's why I said there's a bit of magic that goes on before these frequencies lock.
Yes.
And I can't explain that in 30 seconds.
All right, just another.
Go
one.
Read the brief.
Not those R and N. How can you change a frequency
of
it? I mean, it
must
be pretty complicated.
No, simple. It's divided by any count. It's usually a factor of. Well, it's an integer divider. It's a shift register. You haven't done those individual electronics. You put in a frequency of 10 megahertz and divides it by 2, gives you 5 at the output. By triggering on every second cycle, to divide by 2 counter. It's a countdown counter, or whatever you call it. You've never seen them before. They're quite ordinary electronic devices, frequency dividers. It's frequency multipliers that are tricky. Phase lock loop is how you do frequency multiplication, if you want non-integer multiplication of frequencies. But if you want integer multiplication of frequencies, or rational multiplications of frequencies, is done by the phase lock loop, obviously. But an integer division of a frequency is a simple counter device that consists of flip flops. No, nothing special about it at all. Let's do a literature search after the lecture. It's a bit of a show you what that is. Yeah, is that all right? I'm sorry, Dad.
Yeah.
You have to take my word for that. There are things called divide by end counters, they're often called too. Yeah.
So,
the input for the VCO is a DC, I call it DC voltage pejoratively, but as Tom has just discovered, it's an oscillating voltage. When the phase lock is looped, it's in its NAD phase. And when the frequencies are locked, which is what you're trying to do, it's why it's called a phase lock loop. When the frequencies are the same, then the phase lock loop chooses the right value of phi, right? So that the DC voltage here drives this at exactly the right frequency here. And if the phase ever gets wrong so that phi changes, the VCO forces the frequency, and that's a very tricky manoeuvre. When you think about it, but it's got an integrator in the loop, the filter namely, that makes it impossible. The filter is actually in frequency space, even though it's acting on voltages. It's the output of the phase detector, therefore it's already in the loop. The phase lock loop is actually this part, right? Because this is fixed in time and doesn't vary, it's this bit. And that's all in the phase and the frequency domain, okay? Alrighty, I better get a move on. Is that all right now? You really got that, Miss Anne, haven't you? Because we can pick it up in the tutorial if you like. Rightio, and there it is. Now that looks like a right bloody mess, and it is, except that it gives you a smorgasbord of phase detectors of different architectures for you to choose, so you can forget about half of that. The bit grabbing device is in the middle, which is complicated because you have to program it from the output. Oh, here it is over here. This is where you program it. There's the bit grabber. Now, this is all this bit grabber does is it sets the values of N and R. That's all it does. You've got to tell the phase lock loop what N and R are, and in all cases, phase lock loops are programmable. They have a bit of programmability. They don't classify as direct digital synthesizers by any means, because they're crazy analog things that swing around in the wind and eventually catch what they're locking onto, like all analog circuits, feedback circuits. All right, but here we are, the oscillator in and F in. The VCO comes in here to an amplifier. There's a 16-stage N counter. The clock comes in up here to a 15-stage R counter. Okay, so R and N are not the same, obviously, as we already know. Forget about all that. There's the programming interface for the bit grabber. That's this guy here that changes the values of R and N. And then the rest of it, well, there's some control voltages you're not interested in. You use about half the pins on this, honestly. I don't know why they made it so complicated, because I think when I saw that for the first time, the only reason I ever bought this for any project was because it was the only thing that does the job on the market. Just about. I mean, you can buy some expensive mini-circuit stuff that does the whole thing for you, but it's much more expensive than this. But anyway, that's what it is. It's actually a very simple device, and I already have one working, so you can play around with it. All right, in the next week, we're going to understand how to design these things. This is the VCO you're going to build. Right? Now, the circuit components are wrong, because this almost certainly dates back to when I was using an MRF-157 transistor. Now you're going to be using a BF-199, and the design I have for you, the demo design, actually uses a BF-199 anyway. These are varactor diodes, which are voltage variable diodes. The phase lock loop comes in here, feeds this voltage in the tank circuit of a clap oscillator. This is called a clap oscillator, and it's characterized by the clap oscillator is its feedback path is through the emitter here. So when this starts to oscillate, it feeds, you know that the voltage here and the voltage here are in phase, so it feeds into its own tank circuit from the emitter. Okay, so this thing is, if you like, it's a common emitter oscillator. That's all it is. And this thing just sits there oscillating at a frequency determined by the components in the tank circuit. An inductor that you keep here, you have here, and these varactor diodes. And that's just a blocking capacitor. And the rest of these resistors are here for only bias purposes, so that the transistor's not biased into cutoff, in which case all of its S parameters will be minus J or something, and the thing has no gain and will never work. So you have to bias the oscillator externally from a power supply, 12 volts actually, and then this thing just goes by itself, magic. And what we're going to do is predict at what frequency it will oscillate, assuming that we know these values. And that's all you need to know, because you can never predict what the amplitude of an oscillator is, unless you have PSPICE or some other sort of analysis program. All right, direct digital synthesizers. I'm running out of time again. What's this? Might actually continue on with filters in the tutorial if we don't have any other demands from people. I don't know how correct that clock is. Can somebody else confirm the time, please, for me?
9:47.
All right, let's start looking at direct digital synthesizers. I'll have enough time for that. We'll do filters in the field. Direct digital synthesizers. In many ways, they seem a lot simpler than phase lock loops. You don't have any design to do with them. Plug and play with them. They're integrated. They're fundamentally different to phase lock loops in that the only time that the signal ever becomes analog is after the DAC. So they have a DAC, digital to analog converter, and low pass filter, and the rest of it's done in software. Now, these are not the only numerically controlled oscillator architectures that you can have. A DDS. But we have to separate numerically controlled oscillators into those that are capable of approaching a gigahertz in frequency and those which will forever be at 1 megahertz, okay? The DDS architecture here is pushing a gigahertz nowadays, so it's well behind phase lock loops and VCOs still, but it has some advantages. phase lock loops will never have. One of them is frequency resolution. All right, here's how it works. You have a clock. Like with the phase lock loop, it all starts at the clock. Okay, the clock is a dead, dumb, oscillating tone that never changes frequency. You buy it from a shop and it sits there forever, 100 parts per million, or you can make it an atomic clock and do a lot better if you like. But usually these $10 ones are 100 parts per million or 10 per million. Then you have an address counter. An address counter is just like the counter I spoke to Tom about. It now, on every cycle of the clock, it produces a new binary number that represents an address. Sounding like a computer, isn't it? All right. The address counter then goes to this sign lookup table. What's a sign lookup table? Well, you won't believe it. This is the punchline. This, if you understand this, you understand how this works. It is a sine wave, a single cycle of a sine wave stored in a ROM. So the addresses point to the location in the ROM. It's easy to draw. Right, so it's easy to picture it with a sine wave. Here's the ROM. Along the x-axis here are the address locations, and they increase incrementally as they do in computers, right? The address space of the ROM. There are usually peeps of them, 2 to the power of 48. That's where they get their frequency resolution, as you'll see in a minute. And the sine wave, well, usually pretty lousy sine wave. It might be 8-bit, an 8-bit sine wave. So these are 8-bit bytes representing the amplitude of the sine wave. And that's stored in ROM. So fast memory. After that, you go to a register. And the register does nothing. It's like a gatekeeper. It says, oh, you've got a voltage, a set of bytes for me from the ROM. Remember, it's 8 bits. Right, so in comes the first byte, 8 bits. The register clocks that out on the same clock that causes the address register, the address counter to increase by 1 on every cycle of the clock. And then it just sends that to the DAC and the low-pass filter, and you've got a sine wave. So what's it doing? On every cycle of the clock, it increases the address for the next time round, and at the same time, the register admits the previous value of the sine wave to the DAC. And when the address counter gets to the end, it starts all over again because sine waves are periodic. What could be simpler than that? Who can see what problem it has? the problem is hilarious. This thing doesn't work. Sorry? I haven't put the answer there up for you. Now I haven't. What's that? Where the end was, doesn't need to know where the end is. The address counter overflows back to zero. What's that?
Depending on how big the low-pass filter.
Yeah, you'll see in a minute it suffers from Michael's criteria, so you have to have a low-pass filter there. You know Michael's sampling theorem has that problem, but I'll get on to that in a minute. That's not the problem this has.
It's just hard to tune what the gap is.
Absolutely. If the frequency coming out is constant, and it's equal to the minimum value we can possibly have. In other words, this thing's a real dumb clock with a clock driving it, a better clock driving it. In other words, you put in a 1 megahertz clock and you get a 1 nanohertz frequency signal at the output that does nothing ever. It'll never produce a radio frequency or anything. It'll never be tunable. And the high resolution that it has built into it cannot be exploited. Everyone see that? Yeah, because every time the clock ticks, you just move to one extra address by one at a time. That's all it ever does. It's like a deaf person answering a telephone. Sorry?
What's
that? Who can tell me what we should do? Who can tell me how to change this architecture to make it useful?
It's a very basic architecture.
No, it's a ROM. You can't vary it. Well, that's possible. And the clock's always fixed, but you've got the right idea, just reword it. The problem is increasing the address location by 1 is the problem.
Yeah,
there, isn't
you
it?
Can increase it by 1.
By, absolutely. That's all you do. Unfortunately, when I first saw how you implement that idea, then this was it here. Oh, crap. I've got a lot of words here. Forget that view graph. I've explained it ad nauseam. Right, so here's the idea that... that Bridget's mentioning. All right? What we have is a parallel delta phase register M, and that's the number of locations you jump in memory. Right? You feed that into a phase accumulator, okay, in which causes the address spaces to increase. So that the address spaces increase by M all the time. And then this phase register now outputs the actual address. Okay? So you feed back the current address, which is M, add M to it, and then you'll go to M plus M. That's all that stupid thing showing. I don't like this figure, but it's not mine. I got it from Motorola. No, it's not. It's Analog Devices who are heading the field at the time in direct digital synthesizers. Anyway, so there it is, and then you have the sign lookup table, and the rest of it's the same. So that's a complicated figure, but all it means is add M, which you program, and then you can set the frequency. All right, so how do you calculate that M? Right, the fundamental problems of the frequency control, this is obviously how you do it. It isn't. I got that formula wrong. Sorry. Okay. The frequency is F times the clock frequency divided by 2 to the N, where N is that frequency resolution I was telling you about, the 48 there, and I think it's 48 in the case of the 89854. So, and there's the M. Now, this first part of it is sort of obvious. When M is 1, it's kind of obvious, isn't it? Because you've got one cycle of the sine wave, and you've got to wait 2 to the 48 times before the thing finally got millihertz. If you've got a 10 megahertz clock, it's tiny, tiny. By the time you get to the end here, right? So this is really slow. So all you do is jump locations. Instead of going from there to there and then to there, you do this, okay? And then you automatically increase the frequency by how many steps of address steps you take. That's all there is to it. You'd think it's such a simple device. Why didn't they invent one before, or what's wrong with them? Well, the fundamental problem is that the maximum frequency you can ever get out of this is the clock frequency divided by 2. Who can see why? Sorry? Nyquist, got it. You said that, did you? Nyquist? No. Who understands why that's the case? This is Nyquist theorem. Because normally when you talk about Nyquist theorem, you talk about trying to sample an analog signal, okay? This is no different. But the sine wave stored in ROM is the signal being sampled here. You must have, on a pure sine wave, 2 samples of it in order to recognize it as a sine wave. In actual fact, that seems strange. You might think, well, how can I only have 2 samples of a sine wave and end up with a sine wave after that? And the answer is because of its spectrum. The first harmonic is left completely undistorted, and you can filter out all the rest of those spikes from those 2 things, and you get the sine wave back perfectly. In other words, Nyquist theorem reinstitutes all of the rest of the samples for you. However, if you go anywhere above that, if half of FC, then the DBS is useless. Although you can use oversampling in them, I'm sure, for esoteric applications. But unfortunately, it's a big limitation. It means you've got if you want a high frequency DDS, you need a jolly big clock. And the way that the AD9854 does it is it has a phase lock loop to generate the clock. So you put in a 20 megahertz clock, it up converts, the phase lock loop makes that 300 megahertz, and then the DDS divides it down to a signal less than 150 megahertz. And how roundabout is that? And it's leaning on phase lock loop technology. And there's its spectrum. I don't know if I'll go into this, it's probably a bit. This is the clock frequency at 100 megahertz. This dotted line here represents the amplitude at the output of the DAC. And you can see you get nothing if you try that frequency. At 50 megs, you get about a half of the signal. And you get these images. These images appear at the clock frequency less the frequency you're aiming at. So if you try for 30 megahertz, you will have an image, an undesired signal, at an amplitude given by that sine wave. That's a sync function envelope. Now, to get rid of the image, of course, you filter at half the clock frequency, Nyquist theorem, and you're up. And then all you're left with is this guy, which you want. All right, so there's the AD9854. You can see it's a big device, but once again, it's a really simple device. It's got bells and whistles, like an analog input and a clock out. It's got a comparator, because it had a bit of extra floor space, obviously. So it's got a comparator. So if you get that thing, I should have blocked it out. This is its programming interface, and this is an amazing interface. All you'll have to do is, oh no, you won't. You'll have to program this using 8-bit parallel load. The incredible thing about this guy is that, all right, here it has, what you have to do with the DDS is program that M. You have to program M. That's all this is about, right? Although this guy has a few bells and whistles, you can program a few things more. Your clock comes in here. This is the phase lock loop. No. Sorry, that's the frequency accumulator. So 300, they haven't got the clock, the phase lock loop here. You've got your 300 megahertz, you've got your accumulator, and it actually produces real and imaginary parts, the I and Q in phase and out phase signal. You can control their amplitudes in 12 bits, each individually. So you can produce an I and Q separate radio frequency output, arbitrary amplitude and arbitrary phase, in real time at about 100 megasamples a second. In other words, you've got a 100 megahertz radio signal sitting there on both of these outputs, 90 degrees out of phase with each other, and you can control the amplitude in their phase 100 million times a second, almost the frequency itself. So this device is a data converter, data in, analog out. It does everything you ever need to do in any transmitting wireless device. Okay? Yes, sir. Well, we've got to go, have we? All good things must come to an end. Oh, I missed out on my last view graph, and then I would have got on to the 7.4. Might do that in the tutorial. Right.